Convenience has become a pretty important word in the last 2 decades. With all the technology and innovation on tap this here, and it shows up in 24 hours, whether that's an Uber Eats or an Amazon delivery, we've all been conditioned to get what we want when we want it and not wait for it. And so how do you create a convenient lifestyle for people in terms of where they live? Bringing those diversity of products where I can have a multifamily apartment complex sitting next to a $200,000 townhome community that's sitting next to a $500,000 single family neighborhood. If you're forcing everyone to go off site to get everything they need, you're not delivering on the promise of sustainability.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lanfair, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Tom Hoban. Tom is a real estate investor, developer, and president at Kitson & Partners, the team behind Babcock Ranch, a planned community designed around environmental sensitivity and sustainability. On the podcast, we discuss the housing crisis, methods to developing vibrant and profitable planned developments, and how a strong but flexible urban planning is the basis for a profitable commercial real estate investment. If you're interested in this development or development in general, this is a must-listen podcast.
Tom, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Thank you, Gordon. Thanks for having me.
So why Babcock Ranch?
Why Babcock Ranch? Good question. So I guess if I step back, before Babcock Ranch was Babcock Ranch, we were looking for opportunities in the state to grow and develop. And the state was on fire. It was 05, 06. So trees were still growing to the sky before the great financial crisis. And we were looking a little more creatively at how to get access to deal flow. And we were looking at the opportunity to kind of buy or contract to buy agricultural land and convert it to mixed use or development, residential, commercial development. And so we're looking at a couple of different projects, and Babcock in general had been a deal that the state of Florida had been trying to pursue to purchase to complete a natural wildlife corridor that would extend from Lake Okeechobee, that's kind of in the center of the state, all the way west to the Charlotte Harbor Basin, which is basically the Gulf of Mexico. And there was one missing piece of land in that stretch of land that was Babcock Ranch. And so the state was trying to acquire that from the Babcock family. We knew the state was after it. We knew the state wanted to buy the land and that the family wanted to sell the C Corp that owned the land, not the asset. And so while those two couldn't quite figure out how to get that done, we stepped in and we contracted to buy the Babcock Florida Company, which was a C Corp that owned the 91,000 acre Babcock Ranch. And that was our avenue into getting control of the project. Knowing that the state wanted to buy it, we knew the state wanted to preserve most of it or all of it if they could. And so part of our strategy was to step in, contract to buy it, and immediately engage with the state to figure out what they wanted to do in terms of preservation. And the land has been around, you know, forever. And the Babcock family owned it for about 100 years. And it was most of it was very pristine. A lot of wetlands, a lot of great old Florida land. They did have operations on it. They had an ag operation, a cattle operation, a mining operation. So there were parts of the land that were impacted by those businesses. And so we were able to really get in there, bring in the environmental community, which is a bit of an odd thing for a developer to do. But we did that up front, get them in and help us draw lines on the page as to where were the sensitive areas to stay out of, to keep pristine, and where were the areas that had already been impacted by the family through their operations over the years, to use those areas for development.
And why do you bring them in? Because there are so many developers that are always constantly fighting with environmental groups. Why did you think that was the right idea?
That's a great question. It was a bit of a counterintuitive idea, and it was not without risk because of what you just highlighted. There tends to be more of a combative relationship between developers and the environmental community. But given the size and scale of the project and given the approvals that were required to get from an agricultural piece of land to a residential and commercial piece of land, we knew there was going to be heavy involvement from the environmental community to make sure it was being done properly and done the right way. So rather than guess and swing and miss a bunch of times and perhaps upset the apple cart, you know, we thought it might be best to bring in those experts on the environmental side who had strong convictions and views as to where we should and shouldn't develop, and let them sit at the table, give them a seat, give them a voice. And you know, it wasn't without risk, but I'll tell you, it really paid off. There was a real sense of ownership. There was a sense of accountability that came with it for us. And, you know, it led to a very strong relationship that we've got to this day with the environmental community, Audubon Society, Florida Fish and Wildlife, the WWF, even the Sierra Club. Ultimately, they all came around to our side in support of the project. And so by bringing them in and having them help somewhat shape, you know, where we're going to develop and where we're going to stay out of from an environmental perspective, they became advocates for us out there publicly in the community as a developer who was really trying to do things the right way and embrace the environmental community, bring them into the fold, not cross our arms and keep them out, but bring them in. And we created a lot of goodwill out of it and a lot of good relationships that really helped us through the approval process.
Yeah. In terms of the approval process, would you say that your original intention was to have an environmental focused community and that was then kind of a part of it, or was the process of bringing folks in what spurred that environmental emphasis?
I would say from the jump, we knew this was going to be an environmentally sensitive community. You know, it's Babcock Florida Company, the C Corp, owned a bunch of assets, one of which was the Babcock Ranch, 91,000 acres. It's 143 square miles. It's a lot of land. And the state wanted to buy 73,000 acres of that. So 80% of it was going to be sold to the state for preservation. So, you know, here yet you're left with 18,000 acres of land surrounded by 73,000 acres of preserve that's on our property. And across the street from our property, the Babcock family had gifted about 60,000 acres of land to the state of Florida back in the 50s. And so you're truly surrounded by nature on all sides. So, you know, we really stepped back and took real appreciation for where we were as a developer and in the environment around us, and really put our antenna way up saying, how do we be incredibly sensitive to the habitat and species, flora, fauna, water, you name it? How do we really embrace it and make that part of what differentiates Babcock from its peer groups in the region of Southwest Florida? So that was probably step one of our strategy, was to really embrace the environmental aspects of it and highlight those as differentiators and even kind of almost as amenities for Babcock Ranch. We've got these incredible wetlands and vistas and view corridors when you drive through Babcock Ranch that most communities don't have because we left a lot of that untouched.
So let's step to something more untouched as well. So one of the reasons why we brought you on in particular is there's all these communities that are looking to redevelop and reshape things up. And I think there's no more interesting way than to look at what the ideal community should be than a community that is starting completely fresh and trying to build an ideal community, which is Babcock Ranch, right? So in terms of that, what was the inspiration behind kind of creating a community? And then, like, what did you envision to create a community that has like long-term success over, you know, multiple generations of almost development at this point?
Yeah, great question. So we've been in this business for a long time, and most of our life prior to Babcock in the master plan community business was taking over broken communities that the prior owner ended up stumbling on and needed to get out of, whether it be through a bank sale or directly from that seller. And, you know, Sid Kitson and I had kind of, you know, joked over the years, it'd be great to take over a project from the beginning and not try to take over these broken ones and fix them, which is a great way to, you know, I think, you know, generate a good positive return for your investors and your company, but to get it right from the start. And so this was like a times 1,000, right, in terms of size and scale. So when the opportunity came along, I think Sid and I were pretty excited about just the idea of having a clean sheet of paper, a white canvas, and, you know, size and scale of it, right? So even selling 80% to the state, we're still left with 18,000 acres, which is bigger than the island of Manhattan. You know, so it's a big piece of land, and 19,500 homes, 6 million square feet of space is a lot of entitlements. Should be home to about 55,000, maybe even 60,000 people when we're done. And so the gravity of that also started to hit early on. So, wow, we've got a real responsibility here. We've got a real obligation here to do this the right way. and to really embrace innovation. And it, when you have a project that's that big, it's going to take you multiple decades to get through that. There's going to be multiple cycles. And so how do you package protect? How do you future-proof a community like Babcock Ranch? And so we that's where we kind of started out of the gate. You know, environmental was staring us in the face all around us. We wanted to embrace that, but we also wanted to embrace what's coming down the road. What's down the pipe? And how do we get ahead of the trend? How do we get ahead of the curve and maintain that position along the way? And so the idea of let's not fight nature, let's embrace it, let's lean into nature. Mother Nature tends to win. You know, we try to fight it oftentimes as developers, and we try to mitigate wetlands and redirect water flows, et cetera, spend a lot of money doing it. And then when these storms hit, Mother Nature tends to win. So we said, let's prove that we can actually work with Mother Nature in a responsible way and not have a negative impact on the land around us, actually have a net, no worse than net neutral, if not net positive effect on the land around us. And so we spent a lot of time studying the old maps from the early 1900s when this land was not farmed and not ag, and kind of what the natural condition of the land was, the natural flowways of the property. How did rain, you know, make its way from the north to the south? The property slopes north to south, so the natural flow kind of runs south. Where do those flowways run? And where do those wetlands retain that water? And how do we reconstitute and rehabitat, you know, those wetlands and those flowways? And so we actually spent money, you know, on the engineering side to, you know, basically redevelop a lot of the old weir systems on the property to help, you know, water manage and restore our natural habitat, restore our wetlands. And so rather than kind of plow through our wetlands and mitigate those for to create additional uplands to sell more land, you know, we put money into restoring those wetlands and rehabitating, you know, making a new ecosystem, if you will, this to what it was back in the 1900s for the wildlife corridors within Babcock Ranch. And so I've got some great visuals I can share with you on that that show kind of befores and after pictures. But again, that's part of our calling card was going back to how the land used to be. Listen to the land, embrace it, and don't fight it. And I think water management in our region is a big deal. You know, we go through a storm season every year, and it's a 6-month, you know, extending, maybe even 7-month storm season now, where you've got to be prepared for these weather events. And it's not just wind. A lot of it's rain. A lot of it's flooding. And we saw that this year. You've seen a lot of the horrific stories that have come out of the Carolinas and what happened with Helene as it blew through Florida and made its way north into the southeast and the damage it caused. And so how do we anticipate, you know, that trend is coming? How do we stay ahead of it by getting innovative on our planning and design and maybe spending a couple extra bucks on engineering up front? But I got to tell you that the payback on those extra bucks up front, when things like Ian hit and Helene hit and Milton hit, you know, it pays for itself 10 times over, if not more, with respect to planning and design.
Yeah. So how have you fared in general? Pretty well through all the storm cycles that have come through over the last decade?
Yeah, so we bought the property in 2006. Something happened in 08 or 09 that rocked the world a bit, including ourselves. And we ended up breaking ground on Babcock just about 9 years ago, almost to the day. We broke ground in November of 15 on Babcock. And so since then, we've had a couple storms. Irma came through before we had anybody living at Babcock Ranch. We're still in development mode, so no one had actually moved in yet. Which was good, though, because we got some good lessons learned from Irma. And then Ian is really the storm that came through in 2022, about 2 years ago, that really put us to the test. That was really that was our test. You know, we had spent all this time and effort on planning, design, engineering, visioning. How do we create a really storm-resilient community, safety, security, reliability, redundancy? We're the first solar-powered town, so we've got almost 900 acres of solar. Over 750,000 panels of solar that power the town, 150 megawatts. Everything's buried underground. So all of our power, Wi-Fi, we've got fiber to every house, every business. So all this has been in place. We've been talking about it a lot. We've been getting great, you know, press, great PR. People are moving in. And here comes Ian. And the path of Ian was truly right over the top of Babcock Ranch. You know, when you look on the Weather Channel, they show you where's this storm going. And the Weather Channel says it's going to Babcock Ranch. That's a moment that'll stop you in your boots and kind of have you take stock. So that's all the lead up to it. I think, you know, holding your breath that all this is going to work and all this planning is going to pay off And, you know, I'm not sure how much attention you pay to the storms down here in Florida. But Ian was a pretty severe storm, you know, a Category 5 storm coming towards shore. It slowed down a little bit when it hit to a Category 4 and absolutely devastated Fort Myers Beach, Captiva, Sanibel. That whole area just got absolutely wiped out. And the path from there inland towards Babcock, largely destroyed and complete, you know, devastation. And, you know, I was not there. I was over on the East Coast of the state. Sid Kitson, my partner, was there for the storm. So he and I were in pretty regular dialogue. And, you know, as all this mayhem is going on and chaos is going on in Southwest Florida, Babcock really stood tall. It stood tall and passed the test. We never lost power. We never lost Wi-Fi. We did not flood. Our water utility that we own and operate maintained functionality, never lost the utility. And, you know, we had winds, certainly a lot of wind, you know, that blew through and a lot of rain that came through. People certainly had some signs down and some, you know, some maybe some screen enclosures that got blown a little bit. But in terms of building structures and community-wide, largely intact without much issue. And we're really the only silver lining in Southwest Florida to point to. Everything else around us had been devastated. And we became a bit of this kind of beacon that was still powered, still had electricity, you know, still had Wi-Fi, and folks were coming from all over the region to Babcock Ranch, to our public shopping center at Babcock, which still had operational, you know, capacity. And, you know, our shelter on Babcock Ranch's community, our storm shelter was being occupied by the folks in the region who had been displaced. And it really almost kind of put Babcock not on the map, but it really got our name out there as a place that, you know, what's going on there? How do those guys do this? You know, how do they differ from the rest of their peer group in the region? And 60 Minutes had come to town just to do a story on the storm, on what happened with Ian. And obviously they kept hearing about Babcock Ranch and how this one place kind of, you know, bucked the trend. And we ended up on 60 Minutes that week. And that became obviously a global story. And people got very curious about, you know, what do these guys do differently? How do they end up in this position? And so that was a big test for us. You know, we're really proud of how we performed. Our hearts were breaking for the region. A lot of our colleagues and friends and loved ones that live in Southwest Florida suffered a different consequence after that storm. And we did everything we could to help the region and reach outreach and support. Fast forward the last couple of years, Helene blew through a couple of weeks ago. It was a little bit north of us, so we got some significant rains and wind, but nothing substantial. Milton came through a week later, similar, a lot of wind and some rain, but Babcock was fine. No, never lost power, never inconvenienced the community. You know, part of the environmental story, when you actually lean into your wetlands and you keep your wetlands and you look to restore your wetlands and enhance them, they become incredible storage facilities with water. You know, that water, that natural flowway I talked about north to south, and where that water wants to run naturally, it runs to the wetlands. And if you keep the wetlands, they become big reservoirs to store. So your roads don't get flooded. The houses don't get flooded. So it becomes an amenity, you know, in times of storm. And we have a really intricate, smart stormwater management system that basically communicates with the NOAA and kind of can do predictive analytics on storm activity and rainfall. And we can, you know, raise and lower the levels of our lakes based upon our permits to try to mitigate flood risk within the community. So all that combined really helped lead to a successful outcome for us.
So in terms of that and the general success of weathering storms, has that given you a general benefit in Florida? Because I know one of the larger issues that I hear consistently with Florida developers and developers just in the Southeast in general is the increase in insurance premiums. Mm-hmm. And it just insurance in general is through the roof. Have you seen insurers perceive Babcock differently than some of the other sites in your area?
You know, that is a really good question. And unfortunately, the answer is not yet. We're working on that. You know, I think the insurance industry tends to paint with a broad brush. We got to get a fine tooth comb to really kind of look at micro data. And, you know, we are being treated no differently than a lot of other much riskier regions and neighborhoods, which isn't appropriate given the actual risk profile of Babcock Ranch. We're 30 miles inland. We're 30 feet above sea level. And there's a lot of great data out there in terms of just what's transpired over the last several years of storm activity. Even if you just look at claims data, you know, where are the claims coming from? You know, by and large, they're not coming from Babcock Ranch because there's been no there's been little to no damage. So we think that's a big opportunity. We need to do a better job of educating the insurance industry as to what it is we're doing and why we're different and why we should be treated differently from a risk assessment perspective. We think there's options out there for us to do that. We're exploring it. Had some pretty good preliminary conversations with a few groups. We're going to keep pushing on that because we do think that, you know, that segues into affordability and attainability, just whether that's home price, monthly payment, et cetera, and insurance premiums are a big part of that affordability story.
So let's talk about we talk about the housing crisis a lot on the podcast. So people want to live in affordable, attainable, and communities that they can kind of live and work in. How did Babcock address those issues generally when they were trying to develop a community for, you know, a multi-generational development scheme?
Yep. Look, this is probably, even globally, this is probably one of the top issues in global housing. It's just affordability. And coming off the heels of this inflationary environment that we've all been living in, it's gotten even worse. So it's something we all need to focus on. Our experience way predates that because, you know, we bought Babcock back in 06. But even back then, we recognized we wanted to be a multi-generational town. So we didn't want to just be a retirement community. We wanted to be a town that had families, everything from young families, young 20-somethings up through retirees and beyond. And to do that, you know, you need to have jobs. And to have jobs, you need to have a service industry. And those service folks need to have a place to live as well. So even back in 06, before anyone was really talking about affordable housing, you know, we committed to providing, you know, 10% of our product as attainably priced housing. And so it's roughly 1,800 units, call it just rounded to 2,000 units that would be offered as affordably priced product at Babcock Ranch. And we've been working with that for the last decade. We've got some creative, rental product we think satisfies a big part of that need. We're working on a 340-unit workforce housing project right now at Babcock Ranch. We built our first built-to-rent neighborhood, all single-family homes, 3, 4, 5-bedroom homes. We've earmarked 10% of those homes for policemen, firemen, and teachers, and we've got a special, different rate for that class of employee who qualifies as a teacher, policeman, or fireman to live in the Flatwoods. That's the name of the neighborhood, at a special rate for being a policeman, fireman, or teacher. So we're very aware of it. We think it's a huge opportunity, again, to further differentiate ourselves from our peer group if we can really get creative on the product. A lot of that comes down to density. A lot of it sometimes comes down to a little bit smaller product to make the math work. There's lots you can do. And when you have a product the size and scale of Babcock Ranch, we do have a little bit more optionality and flexibility with respect to how we can skin the cat.
And how did you look at that in terms of, there's a lot of communities that are looking at trying to put affordable product in. How ultimately was that equation done? Was it primarily a community interest? What drove affordability?
What drove affordability, or what drove our focus on bringing it to Babcock?
Yeah. What drove your focus on bringing affordability to Babcock?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, look, we just think in general, people, we want to satisfy the entire community, not just the, you know, the high end, but all the folks that live in a town. A town's got, you know, socioeconomic strata, you know, throughout the town. And rather than having folks that have to live 30 minutes away because they can't afford to live in your town, and we're trying to be a very sustainable town, part of sustainability is being able to live, you know, where you work or work where you live and vice versa, and not have to commute 30 minutes, 40 minutes, 45 minutes. So just part of the ethos of being sustainable, I think it forces you to address this question. So where is this product going to sit? How's it going to coexist alongside of market rate product? And how do you make it such that you're not creating a haves and have nots environment within your community? It blends in with everything else. And, you know, when you drive through any given town, there's quite a bit of affordable product. There's quite a bit of rental product. And oftentimes you don't even know it's there, right? It blends in with all the market rate product as well. So it's about creating that ethos that if you live at Babcock Ranch and you work at Babcock Ranch and vice versa, you should be able to reside there without having to commute 30 to 45 minutes.
Why do you think when you were looking at developing product in general, that physical design was so important. Why did that drive the community? I know that's something that I've seen overwhelmingly with your product, is that it seems to be a very high quality product versus mm-hmm. what you would see in a typical plant development. Why was physical design so important?
Appreciate you saying that. So as a developer, you know, our job is really to create the place. And so master planning, permits, approvals, entitlements, design, amenities, lifestyle, you know, we create that. That's the developer's, you know, responsibility. We're not a home builder. And so, you know, we need to bring in the right home builders who buy into our vision and believe in what we're trying to do, and then mirror that in the product of the home product that's being built. And we've been incredibly fortunate. We've got great builders at Babcock Ranch. We've got, you know, 5 of the top 10 public builders in the country are building at Babcock Ranch. They're all building the Florida Green Build Coalition standard of home building. These homes are built to last. They're built with a very stringent code, you know, for our region as it relates to storm activity. So we're very proud of the product. We're also building a lot of the commercial on our own behalf, you know, where we're building shopping centers, we're building mixed use, we're building apartments, we're building built-to-rent neighborhoods. And in those products, you know, we're adopting that same Florida Green Build Coalition standard to make sure that this product's built to last and not going to create issues for us down the road. So it is something we take great pride in. And on the architecture side, you know, we spent a lot of time looking back. Again, this kind of idea of paying homage to the past on the environmental side with the land. We did similar, you know, look backs on architecture and what the Babcock family had on property in their old hunting lodge that they had, the old commissary they had on the property. And we tried to borrow some of that architecture, ranch chic, or whatever you want to call it. There's different vernacular for it. But we try to bring in a new, unique architectural style that blends kind of that ranch architecture with modern design. And if you drive through Babcock and you get to Founder Square, you can see it, you can feel it. It's different, and it feels kind of the place, not completely foreign or contrived, because there is a bit of a throwback to the past with the architecture.
So I know you mentioned sustainability as important for the live work environment, mm-hmm. but why do diverse neighborhoods matter beyond that? Because why can't people just live in one place and go work in another place? What's generally the philosophy behind creating diverse mixed use neighborhood?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think if you look at the math, I think like 73% or so of the U.S. population lives outside of the urban core, right? So 27% or so of our population lives inside of a city, and the rest of us live outside of a city. And when you look at city living, you know, what's the draw? A lot of it's job related. A lot of it's culture related, amenities, convenience, arts, et cetera. You know, how do you replicate, you know, that the attractive qualities of urban living, but bring them into the suburbs, and create that environment in the suburbs? So I think you'll hear a term in our business called Surban, which is bringing some of that urban into the suburbs so that I don't need to commute into the city to get what I need. That might be my job. That might be a ball game. That might be a theater. That could be a great restaurant. And so the idea of having nodes of commercial activity within the suburbs creates that lifestyle that people are looking for. You know, most people aren't looking to commute more than 30 to 45 minutes to get what they need. And so that's part of that sustainability story. It's not just about living there. It's also about bringing the services there that they need. So that's healthcare, that's shopping, that's dining, that's entertainment. And so, yeah, the closer to home those things become, the more convenient it becomes for the homeowner. And convenience has become a pretty important word in the last 2 decades. With all the technology and innovation on tap this here, and it shows up in 24 hours, whether that's an Uber Eats or an Amazon delivery, you know, we've all been conditioned to get what we want when we want it and not wait for it. And so how do you create a convenient lifestyle for people in terms of where they live? And that's part of it. Bringing those services to the communities, bringing those diversity of products where I can have a multifamily apartment complex sitting next to a $200,000 townhome community that's sitting next to a $500,000 single family neighborhood. And all those folks want to go out and grab something to eat. And all those folks have to go out to urgent care occasionally to get some medical attention. And all those folks have to go somewhere, not all of them, but a lot of them have to go somewhere to work. So how do we create the office environment for that as well? So without that, you're not really providing a sustainable outcome for everybody. if you're forcing everyone to go off-site and go everywhere else, go off-site to get everything they need, you're not delivering on the promise of sustainability, in our opinion.
And so, look, that's great. But when we're talking about how to get all those cultural and service industry-related businesses into your community, how did you end up accomplishing that? Because I get it when a developer sits there and goes, I want to put a development, you know, a retail development or, you know, a restaurant or a grocery store in Houston or Chicago or New York or wherever there already are, you know, millions of people or thousands of people living in a community. How did you end up bringing businesses to the community? Was it a field of dreams? If you build it, they will come? Or what was the thought process behind that?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think, so, you know, our business historically is a business where you know, developers try to create places that are going to outperform their competition. And this might be a golf community. This might be a ski in, ski out community, depending upon where you are regionally. It could be a great lakefront community. You know, for us, we said, you know, let's forget all the historical, you know, kind of check the box type communities. We're building a town and we need to build a town. We need to create a town experience here out of the gate. And so instead of us investing our money to build a golf course and a clubhouse and whatnot, we built 65,000 square feet of town. And what do I mean? You know, we built a restaurant on a lakefront. We have a 300-acre lake in the center of town, which is a real natural heartbeat of activity. People gravitate to the water. There's a big walking trail around the lake. And there's a restaurant on that lake. There's a really great public green space that fronts that lake. There's an incredible band shell right at the head of the lake, at the right where the green space meets the lake. And around that horseshoe, around that green space, we put in mixed use buildings. You know, the restaurant, our office buildings there in a 2-story building with a sales center below, a general store called Slater's, an ice cream shop, co-working space above it. Our initial first phase of our school was around that Founders Square location, and then a 27,000 square foot health and wellness building for health and wellness and primary care. And that was kind of our initial downtown. That's called Founders Square. So we were the initial operators and companies that came in to kind of populate it. And we were both the landlord and the tenant operating those businesses to help create that vibrancy and create that opportunity. And so the challenge to your question is, you really can't convince a third party to come in until you have enough population density to support that business. Most companies aren't going to take a loss leader to help you out to come in and give you what you want, right? So you need to have really robust growth to get there. And we've been fortunate. You know, we had our first home buyer at Babcock Ranch in 2018. And, you know, we went from not being anywhere on the top 50 list in the country for master plan communities in terms of sales to being ranked number 5 in the country by 2022. You know, so we had, you know, we went from 0 to 5th in the country in 4 years based upon the place we had created. And so it was working, you know, it was resonating with the public. And so as those rooftops fill in, got about 10,000 people living at Babcock Ranch today. So 0 people 10 years ago or 9 years ago, when we broke ground, 9 years later from groundbreaking, not from first house, 9 years from groundbreaking, we've got roughly 10,000 people, which is roughly 6 years from the first home being occupied. That's a lot of growth. And so the retailers pay attention to that. They see that growth. Publix comes in and says, you know what? We want to get into Babcock Ranch. And Publix is a bit of a bell cow in the retail space. Other tenants follow their lead. And Starbucks follows. And Starbucks comes in. It's a smaller tenant, but people pay attention to Starbucks because they do their homework. And they try to pick, you know, robust locations with lots of growth. Then you get a Marshalls that comes in, which is a TJX, you know, TJX company. TJX regarded as being one of the stronger credits, one of the smarter retailers. You get a couple of those bell cows in, the dominoes start to fall, and the rest of the retailers start to follow suit. So we've been fortunate that we were able to come in and really kind of seed our downtown as Kitson with storefronts for our community to participate in and enjoy the amenities of the general store, the health and wellness, the restaurant, et cetera, which has led to robust population growth. And now, you know, the retail commercial tends to follow rooftops. We've got enough rooftops now where it's truly arm's length, tenant-landlord deals, leases, rents, as you'd expect in the marketplace. And our rents have been phenomenal. The growth has been, it's surprised us. What we're seeing from the demand from the tenants to be at Babcock Ranch is incredibly healthy.
So in terms of that, I know you mentioned retail, but not everybody works a retail job. How have Have you incorporated other businesses into your community, particularly in the crazy, crazy world of post-2020 and much more like the flex work world versus a traditional office-oriented economy?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I think everyone's still trying to figure out where that's going to land. But certainly, I would tell you that about 22% of the folks who live at Babcock Ranch that are working are working from home. And we've got fiber to every home and business. You know, one, at a minimum of 1 gig, you can buy up to 10 gigs if you want it. But we've got fiber to every home and business. So it's a very convenient place to work from home. We also, as I was talking about the amenities, if you will, the mixed-use offerings in Founders Square, one of them is called the Hatchery. And the Hatchery is basically collaborative office space. And so we created an amenity above our market on the second floor for folks to work out of, you know, kind of as you would in a WeWork kind of space. And that's proven to be a pretty big attractive hit. You know, when people are touring Babcock Ranch and they go into the market and they go upstairs and see the Hatchery, their eyes light up. It's great space, well-designed. There's hot desks you can plug into. There's perimeter offices that are all taken at this point around the perimeter offices. But there's a lot of desks in the middle that folks collaborate and work from. You know, the activity in that space has grown dramatically just in the last 2 or 3 years. So to your question, you know, we're not necessarily here to predict where the office sector is going to land long term. We think that, you know, remote work is here to stay at some level, not binary, where you're either in the office or out, but some sort of hybrid version of remote work is likely here to stay. In certain climates, it seems like it's more prevalent than other places. I think Southwest Florida tends to be a pretty attractive place for remote work. But we've got 6 million square feet of commercial entitlements. We've got really great flexibility in our master plan. We can pivot. We can audible as we go. We're anticipating a lot of that 6 million square feet is going to be retail and mixed use. Certainly, there's going to be a lot of office as well at the right time. We think medical office is probably more viable sooner rather than later. We've been contacted by, you know, several companies who have read about Babcock Ranch or seen the 60 Minutes video who are somehow in the sustainability space or the storm resilience space and have shown a curiosity about, you know, can we find some space there to put a headquarters there? Haven't landed those guys yet, but there's a lot of inquiry coming in, curious about what's going on at Babcock Ranch. And you guys haven't lost power. You didn't flood. You stayed operational. And we've been looking for a secondary office location. Why not look at Babcock?
So in terms of secondary locations, one of the big secondary things that's happened is a push away from traditional retail to more experiential retail and e-commerce. I'm curious how Babcock has navigated that kind of change in terms of how they address retail in the community and last mile delivery.
Yeah. Full 100% subscribe to your perspective on this. It's an incredibly high growth segment, e-commerce, right? It's grown dramatically. I think from 2010 to 2020, I think it grew over 7x in terms of volume, you know, from $500 billion to $4.1 trillion of e-commerce globally. So it's a huge, huge business. We think that's going to continue. We think that e-commerce is going to continue to grow as technology innovation continues to improve, as AI becomes more prevalent, and it becomes more convenient and easier, that'll continue to happen. So I think our eyes are wide open to it. We also see that if you look at certain sectors, grocery, for example, you know, much lower, right? Much lower adoption rate. It's still there. It's there. If you peel the onion, it's there in a much more pronounced way in the urban environments than the suburban. People still like to, in general, people still seem to like to touch their fruit and vegetables and their produce and go to the grocery store to get it. So even Publix, which is one of the best private, I think, operators in the country when it comes to grocer, they've partnered with folks like Instacart to come in and be their delivery group. But even they would tell you the adoption rate among their customers isn't what they thought it would be. So
look, they never pick out as good fruit as you do on your own. So
no, they don't. No. You're right. But it's happening. I think what's happening is the format's changing a bit. I think boxes are getting smaller. You know, how you think about certainly big box space The grocery anchored neighborhood centers that have the daily needs that are heavily service oriented and experiential by nature. I think that's the sweet spot, right? That's the least risky, most attractive asset class. And quite frankly, it's probably the most desired by the customer. You know, so when you've got a grocery store that's got a couple restaurants, a couple quick serve restaurants, it's got your dry cleaner, it's got your nail salon, your hair salon, you got to go there to get it. You can't do that virtually. So I think being thoughtful about how you look at your merchandising mix goes a long way. I also think we have a unique, risk mitigant in the sense that we own all the land. And so we own the town. We have a monopoly on the town when it comes to commercial. So we control the supply. So it's not like we're going to be surprised one day because someone across the street from us decided to put in a competing shopping center and now we're competing for tenants. Yeah. So it's really a chess game for us where we're truly looking at our entire commercial footprint and saying, we want the next Publix here and we'd love to have another grocer down here. And do we want a pharmacy over here or not? And if we do, which one do we want? And so we can be very kind of curated if you think about the strategy on the commercial retail, and we can try to target tenants that are less click, that are more click resistant, to that e-commerce click. And so we think there's still a huge desire to get out of your house and go experience a retail environment that's thoughtfully planned and designed. We're getting ready to break ground on a really cool mixed use neighborhood or mixed use commercial zone called B Street. And B Street is basically a 2.5 block extension of Founder Square right off that lake I talked about. And that's going to be restaurants and bars and entertainment and retail. It's going to be a pedestrian-friendly environment with parking on the exterior around it, but the interior corridor, a safe, walkable environment for all the patrons that come to visit B Street. We've got a 255,000 square foot industrial flex site we're building right now, which will have a combination of light manufacturing, some of your services the town needs, like the plumber and electrician who need a place to have their things, will be there. There'll be some more retail-y kind of storefront type things as well. Maybe some like a pickleball, indoor pickleball, gymnastics studio or karate studio, things like that as well. So we're excited. I think, again, we're building a town of 55,000 to 60,000 people. And so those people need services. And some of that's going to come virtually and some of that's going to come physically. And so we're not looking to flood the market and flood our supply with excess retail. We want to give the residents enough of what they need without oversupplying the marketplace and then cannibalizing ourselves.
So to talk about things that have changed, you've mentioned the change that's transpiring. What was probably the biggest change that you've seen in the marketplace for how people live since you broke ground on Babcock?
Wow. The biggest change. I mean, look, there's been so many things that have changed. I think, one of the things I'd say that maybe it's not the biggest surprise, but I'd say that Southwest Florida as a region, again, I'll paint with a broad brush. It's largely retiree driven in Southwest Florida demographically. If you just look at the demos, we led with a school and we put a school in the first phase and that school sold out literally overnight. And that's led to us putting in a permanent school that currently has over 1,000 students in it, K-12. So for us, we've seen a transition of kind of the macro Southwest Florida demos go from what might be a 75-25 retiree to primary family split to being truly 50-50, where we've got half of our buyers are families, are working folks, and folks with children at home. And again, back to design principles and, having a school, if we had not led with a school, that wouldn't be the case. So we've seen and we've influenced, I think, a lot of change in Babcock Ranch by thoughtful design and thoughtful design principles, like bringing a school in early. We didn't anticipate COVID. we didn't know what that was. But designing a community that's got really great outdoor lifestyle options, over 100 miles of biking trails and hiking trails, living in nature, health and wellness as a primary theme for the community. We've seen a lot of people that are focused on a healthy environment. Where they live matters. And I think COVID, at no point in time had your home or your community become more important to you than during COVID because you were stuck in your home and your community. And I think people started to really look at their four walls and their roof and their neighbor and their yard and say, gosh, am I living in the right place? You know, is there something better out there for me? And so I think we've seen a shift in mindset where health and wellness is a much more prominent selling point for people in today's world. And it's interesting. If I asked you, Gordon, what do you think is the number one determinant of your health? What would you guess?
I say living in a walkable community. That's what I would say. But I'm in real estate, so that would be my argument.
Yeah, most people would say maybe it's your genetic code, or maybe it's your diet, your exercise. Certainly, that's all part of it. But your zip code is the number one determinant of your health. Where you live, you know, it's where you live dictates your access to food, and community, and relationships, and healthcare, et cetera. So, you know, we're building a zip code. And so I think, you know, we have a real opportunity to help influence a healthy lifestyle and how we design the community. That comes down from, you know, from materials to wider sidewalks, more street lighting to make it safer, wider bike lanes to make it safe for people to feel comfortable hopping on a bike. So there's things you can do. There's little things you can do in the design side to make it a more comfortable experience for the homeowner to feel good about their health and wellness options.
So what was, do you think, the most important thing in terms of going through and developing a healthy environment? Was it bikes? Was it sidewalks? What do you think drives health and wellness the most in Babcock?
You know, it's a hard question to answer because we have such a diverse, you know, demographic of folks, from the young families to the elderly. And I think they would all probably give you a different answer. But I think if I were to give an overarching answer, it's peace of mind. You know, there's a certain peace of mind when you live at a place that in Florida that is storm resilient. Maybe that's not what you think of when you think of health and wellness, but mental health, anxiety, stress. If you live at Babcock Ranch and you know when these storms blow through, you're gonna keep your power and your lights on, your air conditioning's gonna stay on, your house isn't gonna flood, your Wi-Fi is on, you can communicate with your loved ones. There's a peace of mind there mentally that gives you a great sense of security and safety. If you can get out on a biking trail and tap into 100 miles of trails and get to where you want to go, whether that's a hike, a walk, or a bike, you can get out with a stroller on a wider sidewalk with your spouse and stroll your kids into Founders Square. Or I'll tell you what, the kids that ride their bikes to school at Babcock Ranch would blow your mind. You know, in terms of how I grew up, you know, I'm not sure. I'm older than you, but growing up, you know, we were always on our bikes or walking to places, and that seems to have been lost a bit in society. And, you know, we made it a point in our design to say we want it to be comfortable for these kids to bike to school, and it's comfortable for the parents to allow them to bike to school in a safe setting. So I think all those things, I think, are important. I can't point to one that's more important than the other. But having all those things there, having the 27,000 square foot health and wellness facility there for people to go out and work out, and having a restaurant there that's got some healthy options for folks to eat, you know, all those things, having a community garden where the residents can actually, you know, take control of their own destiny with microgreens and what they're growing in that garden, you know, all those things speak towards health and wellness.
Yeah, I live in a walkable, bikeable community. I grew up being able to bike to school, and I ended up coming back to that community with my wife because I think it's important for our family to live in a community that can do that. And I fully understand how you're structuring things. In terms of structuring things, though, we sadly are getting to the end of the podcast. And one of the things we like to do at the end of every podcast is something called the Final Four. And it's a nice wrap up. It's a nice way to get a little bit more knowledge from you and to learn a little bit more about how you foresee the world going and to learn a little bit more about maybe someone we should bring on next. So the first question, one of my favorites, is, where do you see planned development going and real estate development going in general over the next 10 years?
Okay. Well, we've touched on it a little bit here. You know, one of the things we've been studying is maybe the word accessibility and, you know, the difference between physical access and virtual access and how that's affecting how we live our lives. And think about the lives we were living before COVID and the lives we're living after COVID. Even this, what you and I are doing right here, you know, this was not something that was as easily done, you know, pre-COVID. Getting online, having a podcast, you know, Zooming, doing Teams meetings, et cetera, remote work, e-commerce, telehealth, virtual health, healthcare at home. It just seems like those lines are converging and the ability to live your life through two streams of physical access and virtual access will continue to drive behavior, human behavior. And so getting ahead of that trend, as you think about planning and design, think about product, think about location, it creates a lot more optionality and flexibility from a planning and design perspective, if you embrace it. And, you know, you can do things. You asked earlier, how do you convince, you know, maybe a business to come in early? And we talked about the pragmatic nature of, well, you need the rooftops. You know, virtual is a way to bridge the gap. You know, I don't need to live, you know, within walking distance of the mall or the shopping center if Amazon can get to me in 24 hours. You know, there's that virtual access. I don't need to live within, two blocks of the train depot to get to my job if I can work remotely from home. I may not need to live in an assisted living facility if I have access to virtual health through my technology and my internet and my Wi-Fi and my fiber. So I think there's something there. I think when you think about how to plan and design X acres of town or community, you know, embracing this accessibility idea of designing a community that embraces both physical and virtual access to create a superior lifestyle for the folks living there. And a lot of that comes down to, as you talk about, peace of mind, security, safety, convenience, pricing, affordability, you know, all that. So I think that trend is going to continue. And I think you're going to see more of that in the design principles for development.
So one of the things that we look for when we look at development is we look at developing ourselves. And we have a lot of younger folks that listen to the podcast. And I'm curious, if you could step back in time and give your young self one bit of advice, what would it be?
Wow. All right. That's a really good one, too. You know, so my younger days, I spent the first 8 years of school out of college in New York in Wall Street. So it was a very fast-paced setting. So the easy one would say to just take a breath and look around you because it's moving so fast. But I'd say maybe with more thought, it would be, for the young folks listening, I would say seek feedback. Proactively go out and seek feedback. Don't wait for it. Ask a mentor, ask a boss, ask a trusted relationship. How am I doing? You know, what can I do better? How can I improve? I think, you know, at least back thinking back on my days, you know, you got kind of your one sit down annually for your review, but throughout the year you didn't quite get a lot of feedback. And in your later years, I think you can appreciate more that feedback is a gift. It's not something to be afraid of or threatened by. It's a way to help you grow. And I think, you know, seek it out, be proactive about it and ask for it. It'll help you advance quicker in your career. I think that's something that I would have appreciated more of that back in my early days.
One of the ways that we love to advance in our careers is through books. We find that not everybody can get a great mentor or get great feedback. Mm-hmm. And so one of the easy ways they can do is go and reach out on the shelf and pick up a book. So if there's a book that you would recommend, what would it be?
So I'm more of a history guy, like World War II. I got a lot of books I could recommend there. But in terms of business side, for me, it's a book that's probably not well known. It's called Leading from the Second Chair, by Mike Bonham and Roger Patterson. And you know, I came down here from New York in 2003, so 21 years ago, to join Sid Kitson at Kitson and Partners, and I've been in the second chair, you know, for that run. And so for me, that book has had a lot of meaning about how to be somebody who can support up to that first chair, but also lead to the rest of the troops. Can think about the big picture and the vision, but also get into the weeds, you know, down with the troops, and also be content with where you are, but also still have aspirations to get somewhere else. So that's kind of what the themes of the book are. So I found that personally be pretty gratifying for me.
Like, that's, I think, phenomenal advice. That everybody needs an operator out there. And one of the things that we love to do is to reach out to people who are operating in the world and are out there that are on the forefront of the real estate community. And the whole reason for the podcast is to reach out to some of those voices that maybe somebody hasn't heard of that's doing something amazing. And we're curious, if you know of somebody who should we reach out to next?
You know, it's funny, you know, our industry, the real estate industry is so fragmented and it's so local. Like, we don't have an Elon Musk floating around. And you know this, Gordon, you're in it. I mean, yeah. We don't have the Elon Musk, the Steve Jobs, the Bill Gates of the industry. We just tend not to have that because it's such a fragmented, you know, local business. There's lots of great things happening out there. I'm thinking about who would be a great, obviously my partner Sid Kitson's a pretty phenomenal guy and innovator and leader. He was named Time Magazine's Dreamer of the Year last year. But you're getting your full of Babcock here on this one. I'd say look in your local market. You know, sometimes it's where you least expect it. Smaller shops, they're doing pretty creative things. There's a group called the Housing Innovation Alliance, and the leader of that name is Dennis Steigerwald, and he's the CEO of the HIA, and their mission is really to convene innovators, you know, in housing. And so developers, builders, architects, engineers who are doing things differently for higher sustainability outcomes and net zero home building and low carbon footprints and, you know, healthier materials. And so he might be an interesting guy to talk to because he's got his fingers in a lot of those pies across multiple markets and multiple players. I have a lot of respect for him. He's done a great job with that organization.
Yeah, we'd love to have him on. But before you go, there's one final question that we have to ask. And it's, if somebody wants to reach out, what's the best way to get in contact?
With me?
With you?
Yeah. My email is probably the best way to get me, which is T Hobin, which is H-O-B as in T as in Tom, H-O-B as in boy, A as in apple, N as in Nancy, at Kitson Partners, which is K-I-T as in Tom, S as in Sam, O, N as in Nancy, and the word partners. .com.
Tom, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today. We really appreciate it, and we have to have you on in the future.
Great. Gordon, it was a pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Tom. We appreciate his insights. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, or a review. Your interactions, comments, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.